fantastic suit. The reality was significantly less impressive, but you couldn't tell the Oracle that. He looked at the screens mounted all around the room. 12 apocalypses, and the other options weren't much prettier. He shifted his gaze across the faces of his advisors, all brilliant men and women, all with enormous power and experience, none of which was doing him a good goddamn. The only person offering him any sort of lifeline was, of course, the fucking Oracle.
"I can try to get word to his people," Green said.
"Good," the Oracle said. "Look, do this, play your role, and you can spin it so that it looks like you saved the world. I don't care, I really don't. But do it right, and it should help you get that second term, cancer or no cancer."
"Will it?" Green said.
"What?" came the Oracle's voice, sounding genuinely puzzled.
"Will I win?" the president asked.
A lengthy pause from the other end of the line.
"You will," came the answer. "If you help me. How long will it take you to make contact with Turakul?"
The president exhaled loudly.
"No time at all," Green said. "We know exactly where he is. We've got a special forces team out in the mountains keeping him under surveillance."
"Wait, why?" the Oracle said. "If you know where he is, why don't you just..."
"Because we can't find the damn missile," the president broke in. "The goddamn sword. He's got it hidden somewhere in the mountains, and his people have orders to launch it if Turakul is killed or captured."
Another pause from the Oracle's end of the phone.
"All right. The Special Forces team can get to him," the Oracle said. "It's important that someone conveys to Turakul that I just want to speak to him. He needs to know he'll be released once we're done."
"Of course," the president answered. "We don't want any misunderstandings, believe me. I have Tony Loyston on the ground there. You remember him?"
"Rings a bell," the Oracle said,
his tone bone dry.
"I bet. He'll get it done. What will you say to Turakul?"
"Wait and see," the Oracle answered.
"Listen, you arrogant little..." the president began.
He took a breath.
"Ah, fuck it. When will you be ready?"
"Not long."
"All right, I'll give the orders. I'll call this number when it's all set up." "You know what you're doing," the president said.
"Absolutely," the Oracle answered.
The phone went dead. Chapter 43. The coach took back her phone without a word, her expression impressed, and full of questions she had apparently decided not to ask, for the moment. Will looked out the window. The helicopter had just completed a steep climb up a mountain range, and as they crested the peak, a city came into view. It sprawled next to a deep blue lake, with a cluster of skyscrapers near the center, and endless suburbs scattered across a broad plateau. Will was doing his best to ignore Grunfeld. The man had his pistol resting lightly on one leg, pointed roughly in Will's direction. His finger wasn't on the trigger, but Will had absolutely no illusions that he had any chance of getting his hands on that gun.
"Is that it?" Will asked, nodding toward the window.
"That's it. Denver," the coach answered.
She made a show of pulling up her sleeve to look at her watch, a slim-banded, elegant thing.
"This will all be very public. I hope you know what you're doing."
"I do," Will said.
Across the cabin, Lee was in the far seat against the window, surrounded by three of the coach's men. She had her arms crossed, staring straight ahead, boring a hole through the chest of the mercenary seated opposite. She looked tiny in comparison to her guards, but all attitude, all defiance. Will's confidence faltered a few degrees. If he was wrong. But no, it was too right. And if it wasn't, then he and Lee would both be dead. And there was never anything he could have done about it. Not at any single point since the day he was born.
"All right, Denver,"
Time to get a bit more specific about your plan, Mr. Oracle, the coach said.
Hold on, Will said. Just give me a minute.
Sure thing. How about this? You've got 20 minutes to show me something before I call this whole thing a bad investment and shove you both out the door over the Rockies. Take your time.
Will swallowed. Lee, he said, I need your help. Lee blinked. She turned. She'd been all but comatose for the ride thus far, but seemed to dial herself back to life at the sound of Will's voice. She flashed him a quick, faint smile.
Shoot, she said.
I need the biggest TV station in Denver, Will said. Lee raised an eyebrow.
Okay, she said. You want KUSA. They're the NBC affiliate.
Do you know where they're located in the city?
They have a headquarters building just outside downtown. It's this weird round-looking thing.
Could you recognize it from the air?
I think so, Lee said. It's just up the road from the Denver Country Club. Find that, and I'm sure I could spot it.
They'll have some sort of satellite link-up, right? A way to get footage out beyond Denver?
Of course. Even the smallest local stations can do that. But why do you need a TV station, Will?
Will gave Lee a placating gesture and turned back to the coach. Tell your pilot to look for the country club, a golf course. Lee will direct him from there. And I need you to make a call for me. The coach tossed her phone to Grunfeld.
18 minutes, she said. Use them well.
Will turned to Grunfeld. Dial information, Will told the man. Get...
What was the station, Lee? KUSA, she said.
Right. Ask for their direct line. Then call them and tell them that you've got the Oracle. He wants to make a statement, and he'll be landing on their roof in 10 minutes.
The coach reached out and put her hand on Grunfeld's forearm, keeping him from lifting the phone.
I don't think so, she said. Do it, Will said.
The coach leaned forward.
Will, you've clearly decided I'm an idiot, which surprises me. If there's anything you should have learned from our time together, it is that I am exactly the opposite of an idiot. I said I'll help you, but I'm not letting you out of my hands. And I'm sure as hell not letting you near any television cameras.
Listen, Will said, keeping his tone level. It has to be this way. I have to get in front of a camera. There's no other way to do it.
Nope, the coach said. I won't be able to keep you under control if you've got an audience. Find another way.
Will closed his eyes and took a deep breath. He opened them and gave the coach what he hoped was a look of the utmost sincerity.
Here's how we do it, he said. You guys stay in the helicopter. Let me outside just for 5 minutes to say what I have to say. And then I'll get back in here and go with you. You can do what you want with me. You have my word, as long as you let Lee go. You don't need her.
Will,
Lee said, horrified.
It's okay, Lee,
Will said, although he kept his eyes on the coach's face. She leaned back in her seat, thinking.
Your word, she said. What's that worth? I don't know you, and I've been threatening to kill you for the last few hours. Why would you keep your promise to me?
Because of her, Will said, pointing across the cabin at Lee. The coach's head turned slowly, following Will's gesture. She looked at Lee for a long moment, then turned back.
This is the only way to do it, the coach said,
that I can think of. She gestured to Grunfeld, spinning her fingers in a go-ahead movement.
It'll go like this, she said. You can have your little TV show, but the girl stays in the chopper while you do. We'll tie a line around your waist, so that if we need to lift off in a hurry, you're coming with us. When you're done, get back in here, and we'll let your girlfriend go at the same time.
No, Lee said. I'm not going anywhere without him.
Lee, Will said. It'll be fine. Don't worry.
It's not going to be fine, Will. What the hell are you doing? There has to be another way.
Will dug deep and gave her the most reassuring smile he could muster. He closed his eyes and leaned back against his seat's headrest, listening to Grunfeld making the call.
They're connecting me, Grunfeld said. How do I convince them I really have the Oracle?
You're the badass son-of-a-bitch soldier of fortune, Will said, without opening his eyes. I sure as hell hope you're tougher than a TV station receptionist.
Chapter 44 A helipad was clearly marked on the widest section of KUSA's roof, a large black H in a white circle. A crowd had gathered around that H, at least 100 people. The coach turned from the helicopter cabin's window and spoke to the pilot.
Keep them spinning, the coach said. We'll need to get out of here in a hurry.
Grunfeld tested the knots on the length of black nylon cord tied around Will's waist. The other end was lashed securely to one of the seat supports in the cabin. Without a knife, it would take half an hour to get free, at least.
So, the coach said, almost apologetic.
I feel like this has to be said. Try anything, and you'll get a bullet in the back of the head.
Won't that happen anyway? Will said.
Probably. But act up and...
She pointed a thumb over her shoulder at Lee.
She'll be next. We'll toss her out after you and fly away.
The eyes of everyone in the cabin were on Will. From the corner of his eye, he saw Lee move, slowly reaching for the pistol in the belt of one of the guards next to her.
Oh no, no, he thought. Lee, don't!
She managed to get it halfway out of the holster before her hand was slapped away, and the guard's fist closed around her throat. Lee made a strangled noise. The guard looked to the coach for instructions.
Jesus, she said. Doesn't know when she's got a good deal.
She leaned in, putting her face close to Lee's.
Just relax, the coach said. You'll be out of here in 5 minutes, if Mr. Dando sticks to the plan.
The guard holding Lee relaxed his grip, but didn't let go. She shoved at his arms, but she might as well have tried to topple an oak.
Keep her quiet, the coach instructed.
The guard's other hand went over Lee's mouth.
Take it easy for God's sake, Will said. You want her out of here? Get on with it, the coach said.
Will glared at her, then put his hand on the cabin door and shoved the handle down. A meaty click as the latch released. He pushed open the door, which split at the midway point, the upper half sectioning up, and the bottom expanding into a short flight of steps descending to the roof. Will stepped out of the helicopter into an eruption of rotor wash, trailing the black nylon tether. The blades were still spinning, as the coach had instructed, but even over the noise they generated, Will could hear the shouted questions from the assembled crowd.
Is it the end? Will my husband stay with me?
Should I play 15 or 26 in the match game? Who's going to win the next Super Bowl? Is the sword going to launch?
Will we ever land on Mars? Where's my daughter?
The faces surrounding the helicopter were manic, frightened, awed. Will hadn't been exposed to this much raw need since he'd sifted through the emails people sent to the site, forever ago. It was disorienting, like a hot spotlight shining right in his face. Will took a deep, focusing breath. He turned back to the helicopter.
Shut it down, he shouted.
Grunfeld, waiting back in the open door to the helicopter's cabin with the ropes in his hand, apparently couldn't hear him. His face was stone blank, as ever. Will made a spinning motion with his hand, trying to evoke the rotors, then made a throat-cutting gesture, signaling for him to stop. Finally, a reaction. Grunfeld's eyebrows lifted almost to his hairline. He shook his head. Will covered his ears with his hands and shrugged. Grunfeld frowned deeply, but shouted something back into the cabin. A long moment, and then the deep thrumming of the helicopter's engine ceased. The rotor slowed to a stop. Ignoring the pleas from the crowd for information about loved ones' futures, stock tips, answers, Will pointed at the nearest camera crew and motioned them forward. A trim, middle-aged man with salt-and-pepper hair seemed to be the man in charge. He was wearing a suit and had a microphone in his hand and had the polished vibe of a news anchor. Once he was close enough, Will leaned over and shouted over the crowd noise, right into the man's ear.
"You're going to have to do an uplink with this signal," Will said.
The anchor gave him a puzzled look. Will pointed at the camera.
"I need this to go someplace specific," he said, in an attempt to clarify. "What's your name?"
"Crandall Fontaine,"
the anchor said, who didn't seem like he had completely processed the situation.
"Okay, Crandall. Do you have a tech guy I can talk to?" Will said.
The anchor nodded. He waved to a heavy-set man standing nearby.
"Jerry, get over here,"
Crandall Fontaine called. The tech approached warily, his eyes never leaving Will's face.
"Jerry," Will said, keeping his voice calm and patient. "Hold on just one sec. I'll need your help."
He turned back to the helicopter.
"I need the phone again," he shouted at Grunfeld,
still lurking in the open cabin door. Will was expecting to have to spend another few minutes convincing the coach to give him the phone, but it sailed out of the helicopter door without a word. Evidently, she had decided she was in for a penny, might as well be in for a pound. Will caught the phone neatly. He turned back to Jerry, the tech, and held it up.
"Now, Jerry, in a little while, someone will call this number. You're going to talk to them and get the signal where it's supposed to go. The footage from here will need to be sent someplace else, I think via satellite, and you'll be receiving another feed the same way. The person over there needs to see and hear me. I need to be able to see and hear them. Can you do that?"
"Yes, sir," Jerry answered. "Should be simple if they have the right gear."
"Good."
Will handed Jerry the phone. He stepped back and looked around the roof, making eye contact with different faces in the crowd, seeing the surge of eagerness whenever someone thought they'd made a connection. They wanted him to help. They wanted him to save the day. Will turned around and climbed back up into the helicopter. He pulled the door shut behind him. The aircraft had good soundproofing. It had to because of the rotor's din. The sudden silence once the door latched shut was a balm to Will's noise-lacerated ears. Will stepped toward the seats containing Lee and the mercenary guarding her.
"Move," Will said to the man.
They locked eyes. A beat. The soldier stood. Will sat down next to Lee.
"What's happening?" she said.
"It's all getting set up. It'll take a few minutes."
Lee considered this.
"Can I ask you something?" she said.
"Of course," he answered.
"What do I do, Will?"
"For a living?"
"Yes," Lee said. "For a living."
"You're a journalist," Will said.
"What kind?"
Will thought this over.
"For a website," he said.
"Correct,"
Lee said.
"So why in the world would I know anything about TV stations in Denver?"
Will frowned.
"I guess I didn't think about it. Just seemed like something you would know. But you did, right?"
Will looked at him, very intent.
"I used to date a guy in college. After graduation, he moved out here and took a job with KUSA. I visited him a few times, saw where he worked. That's the only reason I knew. I shouldn't have, but I did. We had zero time. The coach was 2 seconds from ordering her guy to shoot us, and I had exactly the information you needed, at exactly the right moment. What is that, Will?"
Will exhaled. A long, slow breath that communicated an utter lack of surprise at what he just heard.
"What can I say, Lee?" he said.
"The site provides." Lee reached out and gripped his forearm.
"Please, Will," Lee said. Tell me you've really got a plan?
Answer the lady, the coach said. What are you doing, Mr. Oracle?
Waiting, Will said. He leaned back in the seat and closed his eyes. Chapter 45. The streets swarmed. An immense crowd, thousands strong, had gathered around KUSA headquarters, filling every open spot around the building, flowing across the grounds of the golf course up the street. People screamed, their hands in the air, tears running down their faces. The Oracle had descended from the mountain. He was, in fact, standing on the steps of a helicopter on the roof of the television station with a thick black cord tied around his waist. And oh, the things he could tell them.
Jerry! Will shouted over the crowd noise, calling over to the KUSA technician,
who was standing not far away next to a nervous-seeming cameraman, each holding portable video equipment with cords trailing back across the roof and into the building through an open access door.
How we doing?
Hello, sir, Jerry said. It's all set up. Good to go.
Will looked at the crowd.
This won't work. I can't hear anything. Can we do it in the helicopter?
Jerry thought for a moment.
I don't see why not.
Good. Bring the camera guy inside.
What about Mr. Fontaine?
Will had forgotten about the station's anchor. He looked now and saw him standing slightly off to one side, anxiously awaiting what he thought was his golden ticket, mediating some sort of conversation between the Oracle and Turakul. Crandall Fontaine flashed Will a broad smile.
We don't need him, I'm sorry. There's not much room in there anyway.
I'll let him know, sir.
Will thought he detected a little satisfaction in Jerry's tone. Moments later, Will was back in the helicopter, sitting opposite a cameraman with a monitor next to him displaying a grainy, poorly lit image of the rock-strewn floor of a dry desert canyon. It was night in Kandustan, and outside the circle of light shown in the monitor, the canyon faded quickly into inky blackness. Members of the U.S. Special Forces team who had presumably captured Turakul patrolled the canyon, looking in every direction at once. Lee sat with Grunfeld on the other side of the helicopter, along with Jerry and the coach. The rest of the coach's men had been forced to leave the aircraft. No room. The scene on the monitor shifted as the camera panned quickly to one side. It stabilized, bringing into focus a dark-skinned man wearing desert camouflage gear and a head wrap. The man's arms were extended before him, tied at the wrists by plastic quick-tie restraints. Two huge Special Forces soldiers covered him, rifles held at the ready. Will studied the prisoner. He could only be Turakul. He stood straight, unbowed, unafraid, almost curious. Will wondered what Leuchten had told him about what was happening. As if responding to Will's thought, Anthony Leuchten stepped into the frame. He looked thoroughly miserable, hot, filthy, with some sort of rash covering most of the diminished pouch of fat on his neck.
Is the Oracle online? Will heard him say. We're too exposed out here. This is taking too long.
Will took a deep breath and motioned to the cameraman. Turn it on, he said. The cameraman flipped a switch on the side of his camera, and a red light blinked on.
Mr. Leuchten, Will said. Nice to see you again.
Mr. Dando,
Leuchten responded, his tone clipped and short.
Are you ready?
Yeah.
What about Turakul? What did you tell him?
I told him that the Oracle wanted to speak to him, that he was not under arrest, that he would be released as soon as the conversation was complete, and that whatever you tell him has nothing to do with the U.S. government in any way.
Of course you did, Will said. That's all I need from you, then. Tell your men to cut him loose and step back. I want him free when he speaks to me.
Impossible, Leuchten said flatly. We can let him go once we're done.
Will raised an eyebrow. Tony, Doesn't the fact that your boss set this whole thing up, just because I asked him to, suggest that I'm the one calling the goddamn shots? Get the restraints off him. Now. Loyston's mouth clenched, but he turned and gave the order. Without a word, one of the Special Forces soldiers sliced through the plastic cuffs and stepped back. Turakul immediately began to massage his wrists, but his eyes stayed focused on the camera. All right, Will said. Does he speak English?
No, Loyston said. But one of our men can translate.
Good. The rest of you get back. Loyston and all the soldiers but the translator stepped out of the circle of light, fading back into the darkness. Will watched Turakul for a moment, who seemed content to wait and see what happened next.
Do you know who I am? Will asked.
He realized how much of what was about to happen hinged on Turakul's answer to that question.
Yes, came the translation. The Oracle is known to me.
Will released the breath he'd been holding, a big, relieved sigh. How? Will asked.
The leaders of my faith have spoken about you for some time.
All good things, I hope, Will said, and instantly asked himself what the hell he was thinking. Upon hearing the translation, Turakul gave Will a blank look.
No. No good things.
Will considered this, and decided it didn't matter. Will you listen to what I have to say? He asked.
Everywhere I look, guns are pointed at me. What choice do I have? But I will tell you what I told your companion. Even now the sword of God is being prepared to fly. Say what you like. Every moment brings me closer to victory.
But you were told you would be released.
Turakul gestured at the translator and spoke, his face cold.
These soldiers storm my camp in the dark of night. Kill three of my men, he said.
Will winced.
They tell me, Turakul continued, that the famous infidel prophet wishes a word with me, after which I will be set free.
Turakul stared fiercely at Will.
The Imams teach that you are no true prophet. It is one of the few points upon which all sects of Islam agree. They say that you lie with every word, that you are the devil's child, casting evil words into the hearts and minds of men. So, he said, lie to me.
Turakul spat, the impact on the ground clearly audible.
I will listen. And when I refuse you, these soldiers will kill me. That is apparently the will of God. And what choice do I have but to accept it?
The will of God, Will repeated. I know more than I want to about the will of God.
Will stopped thinking. Nothing he could say would make things worse. He just spoke.
I have nothing to do with the devil, Turakul, Will said. I'm just a man. But I am a man who can see the future. And the things I see happen.
The bees will be 23-12 in favor of returning your mosque to you and your people. I don't know when the council will come back. I don't know if they will meet your deadline. I only know the results. 23-12 in your favor.
Will leaned forward, doing his best to look directly into the other man's eyes. I am asking you to wait. If you launch your missile, the entire world will burn. You have to know this. But wait until the bees return, and you will get what you want. You have my word.
Will waited while the translation filtered through to Turakul, and watched the man's expression harden.
So, you want a favor? Turakul said. Interesting.
He looked away, out of frame. A long, long pause. Will gripped the armrest of his seat. Turakul looked back at the screen, back at the Oracle.
You do not understand the reason I fight. You do not know anything about me. You just want me to do something for you. To keep you safe, in your soft homes, in your soft land across the sea.
Terakul took a step forward, toward the screen. His face was twisted in a snarl.
Fuck you, Oracle. I do not care if you are safe. I do not care if your children are safe. They mean nothing to me. Everything that matters to me and my people is here. And here is where I must act. And so, as I promised, I refuse your request. You have only two choices, false prophet. Kill me now, and the sword of God flies within the hour. Your world will burn, and I will laugh at you from hell. Or release me, and gamble that I will not launch my weapon just because you have offended me. It is your choice, but I am done with waiting. I have power, and I must use it to help my people.
Terakul crossed his arms, and unbelievably, smiled. Will stared at him in silence, and tried to figure out what the fuck he had been thinking when he assumed a 20-something white American guy would be able to convince a Central Asian warlord with a nuclear missile pointed at a city to do anything at all. Terakul was never going to listen to him, would never believe a word he said. It had been so goddamn arrogant to think that the Oracle could say a few words and boom, happy ending. The site had been taking care of him for so long, keeping him alive, protecting him from presidents and lunatics in laundromats and assassin grandmothers, that he just hadn't really even considered that this might not work. But it hadn't. Of course it hadn't. Arrogant. Why had the site spent so much time and effort, burned through so many lives, just to bring the world to the brink? Either the site wanted chaos, or it didn't. If it didn't, then there had to be an answer. There had to be a way to balance the scales. And with that thought, Will understood. At last, the pattern became clear. Yes. The site had done everything it possibly could to bring fear and misery into the world. It killed people. It made them afraid. It took away things they loved. It made them wonder if the future would even arrive at all. But that was not all it had done. The site had created balance. It had created a roiling, spinning engine of chaos and doom. But it had also created a person with the power to stop it. Love him, hate him, fear him. It didn't matter. Will Dando, the Oracle, was the most powerful person in the world. And it was time to stop fighting the future. Leuchten, Will said. Tony Leuchten stepped into the circle of light. He didn't say anything, but his body language communicated immense fury. He was almost quivering. Look at Terakul, Will told Leuchten. Tony inclined his head and narrowed his eyes, but he did what he was told. Terakul, Will said. You know who this man is? Terakul nodded.
He is your president's.
The translator hesitated for a moment.
Special friend,
the soldier finished, obviously choosing a diplomatic way to express the term Terakul had actually used. Will saw Loyston's hands clench. He is the chief advisor to the leader of America, Will said. He speaks for the president. He is an extraordinarily powerful man. Terakul nodded.
Yes, I know this. So he told me. This is why he was sent to treat with me.
Here, Terakul, Will said. A gift. Will took a deep breath, held it, let it go. Captain, stop translating, Will said. The soldier nodded. Leuchten, Will said. Tony half turned to look at the monitor. Get on your knees in front of him.
Fuck you,
Loyston said. Do it, or this whole thing's done, Will said. You want that election. You want to save the world? Get down in the sand.
I represent the United States of America, Loyston said. I can't do it.
Do you really want that goddamn missile to launch, Tony? You can't be that stupid. You can stop it right now. I'm telling you. I know what's going to happen. I'm the Oracle, for fuck's sake.
Will smiled at him.
Sometimes we all have to surrender to a higher power, Tony. Today, that higher power is me.
Even through the monitor, Will could see Loyston's face flush. He slowly turned back to face Terakul. Laboriously, Anthony Loyston lowered himself to his knees, his eyes far away. Down in the sand, facing Terakul, the chief of staff to the President of the United States of America bowed his head. Terakul watched this happen, and then looked back at Will. His attitude had changed. For the first time since their conversation had begun, Will saw a touch of respect in the other man's face.
Captain, start translating again, Will said.
The soldier nodded, waiting.
So here we are, Terakul, Will said. You and me. The men with all the power. You say you need to use yours to help your people. I'm using mine for the same thing. I'm giving you my word, right now.
When the bees come down from the mountains, the vote will be in your favor. 23-12.
Will waited for the soldier to translate his words, then continued.
If you wait, you win. If you don't, everyone dies. I can't tell you what to do. But think about everything I could have done with all this power I have. And then think about what I actually did here tonight. From one powerful man to another. Just consider that I am telling you the truth.
Terakul watched Will's face. Will felt calm. Calmer than he had been in a long time. Possibly since the dream. The warlord glanced at Loyston, still kneeling silently in the dirt, and then back up at Will. He looked off into the distance, his face blank, unreadable, and remained that way for perhaps 30 seconds. Terakul spoke briefly.
I will wait, came the translation.
Will was dimly aware of sounds of relief erupting around him in the helicopter.
Thank you, Will said.
Tony Loyston looked toward the screen, a question on his face. Will kept him waiting for a long moment, then nodded. The other man slowly pulled himself to his feet. Once he was standing, Loyston brushed sand from his clothes and gave Will a look of pure, burning hatred. Will was severely unimpressed.
Thank you, Tony, he said. I'm sure that wasn't easy.
You're a son of a bitch, Loyston spat.
Hey, pal, you were the one who wanted to work with me so badly. You get what you get, asshole, Will said.
Let Terakul and his men go. You heard him. He's going to wait.
How do we know? Loyston said.
Because he made a deal with someone he thinks he can trust, Will said.
Goodbye, Loyston. I hope I never see you again.
Will looked at the cameraman in the helicopter.
Shut it off, he said.
The cameraman flipped off the monitor and lowered his camera. His face was pale, and his eyes wouldn't leave Will's face.
Lee squirmed past Grunfeld into the helicopter's aisle, her eyes wide.
Holy shit, Will, she said.
I told you I knew what I was doing.
Time to go, the coach said. Step lively.
She nodded at Grunfeld, who spoke briefly into a radio wired into his collar. A moment later, the door to the helicopter opened, and the coach's men appeared, motioning to Jerry and the cameraman to exit. As soon as the door opened, Will heard cheers and screams from outside. and more questions. The coach looked at Lee.
As I understand the deal, Miss Shore, she said, it's about time you were headed on out of here, too.
Lee shook her head and looked at Will. He nodded.
It's okay, Lee, he said. I'll be all right. Just go. Be safe.
She's going to kill you, Will.
It's all right, Will repeated. Go. We don't have time.
He's right, you know, the coach said. Get down those stairs in the next 10 seconds or you're coming with us.
Lee abruptly sat down in one of the seats and buckled her seatbelt.
Oh, Lee, no, come on, Will said.
Lady wants to stay, her call, the coach said. Get us up, she shouted to the pilot.
The helicopter's rotors cycled up, their pitch running higher, as the pilot made preparations to return to the sky.
Will collapsed into the seat next to Lee.
Why? He said.
Come on, Will. Shouldn't you know by now? She replied. The story's not done.
Her face turned sober. She looked at the coach, who was giving them both a speculative look.
Can I ask him a few questions, or are you planning to throw us out over Mile High Stadium?
Knock yourself out, the woman said. I've got some questions of my own.
Lee returned her focus to Will.
Will, how did you know that? About the numbers? Are you sure that's what they mean? She asked.
There are 35 elders in the Council of Bees, Lee. It was in the news stories from the beginning, but I didn't make the connection until I saw it in the paper again this morning, and everything clicked. I can't believe I didn't see it earlier.
She looked at him askance.
And the four? How does that fit in?
Will shrugged.
You remember how I told you that the predictions came to me in a dream? They were all spoken. I heard two numbers and assumed the third was a number two. But it's not. It's four. Like, in favor of. Not the number. I just couldn't see it until today.
Lee shook her head, silent for the moment.
My turn, the coach interrupted. I have one question.
Will looked up at her.
Did you just stop the Kondustan situation from going hot? She asked.
Will didn't hesitate.
Yes, he said. I did.
A thank you would be nice, Lee added. Preferably before you shoot us in the head.
The coach crossed her arms and looked out the window for a long, long moment.
Where to, ma'am? The pilot asked.
No answer.
Well, huh, the coach said finally. I guess I've got my limits. I can't do this. Looks like you two get to see tomorrow after all.
Boss, one of the guards spoke up. I have to ask. Doesn't that screw us? I mean, the president gave us a job.
True, the coach said. But as we've heard, he's going to get cancer and probably die. I'm not worried about the president. We're not going to kill the guy who headed off a nuclear war by making Tony Loyston kneel in the dirt. That is an interesting person. You want a guy like that owing you a favor.
The coach, this small, elderly, unarmed woman, looked at her team.
Any of you try to take him down, you will be stopped. By me. We clear?
Clear,
the guards said in unison.
Now, the coach said, looking back at Will. Can I drop you two anywhere?
Will felt Lee's hand curl around his. And with that small gesture, the future opened to him. August 23rd.
And in another example of what is being called the Oracle Effect, a historic peace accord was signed last night in the Gaza Strip between representatives of Israel and Palestine. The terms of the accord were negotiated by U.S. President Daniel Green. Seen here at the signing in.
Of the many, many things Reverend Hosiah Branson wished he currently had access to, perhaps highest on the list at the moment was a remote control. so as to mute the goddamn TV. But the television was inside a wire cage mounted high on the wall, and the remote control was in the hands of the guards who oversaw the cafeteria as their own personal fiefdom. And Branson wasn't getting anywhere near either of them. He glanced around the cafeteria, a quick, furtive look designed specifically to avoid eye contact with any of the other prisoners. Light blue jumpsuits as far as the eye could see. A rumble of conversation. The sights and sounds of about 100 men shoveling the garbage this facility called food into their mouths. No one was looking directly at him, but he somehow had the sense that they were all very aware of his presence, aware of the tray sitting on the table, aware of its contents, aware of the date. How did this happen? He thought. Just the latest cycle of a question that ran on an endless loop in his head. But of course he knew. He had made himself the Oracle's most public enemy, and the world loved the Oracle now, because the Oracle had saved the world. And so the Oracle's most public enemy was the enemy of the world. That included the prosecutor who had made the argument that Branson was a flight risk, and so should be held in jail until the criminal trial related to the attempted murder charges levied against him by the New York City District Attorney's Office. It included the DA himself, who was once part of Branson's circle of influence. It included the judge. It included his wife, whom he hadn't seen since his imprisonment. He looked back at the TV, where an oh-so-dignified Daniel Green was watching the Jew and the Arab shake hands. It included the President of the United States, who had most assuredly cut ties with Reverend Hosiah Branson. It included the entire world. Everyone but Brother Jonas, at any rate. He visited fairly often. The man had proven to be loyal, when all was said and done. Not that his loyalty would gain him all that much. Poor man had backed the wrong horse. Branson looked down at his tray. On it was a yellowish puddle of instant mashed potatoes, a fleshy pile of limp, overcooked green beans, and a gray slab of protein covered by a splat of thick, sewagey sauce. It was inedible, all of it. You just had to season the hell out of it and hope for the best. Branson reached for his government-issued spork, made of a bendable nylon plastic mix that could under no circumstances ever be used as a weapon. It was August 23rd. It was Sunday. And so, it was Salisbury Steak Day. He looked up again at the other prisoners. Now many of them were looking at him, nudging each other. They knew what day it was, too. They were Oracle tourists, in their way. All around, men started to stand from their seats. The guards moved in from the edges of the room, unlimbering weapons from their belts. But they didn't stop the prisoners as they moved into a loose circle around Branson, sitting alone at his table. The guards glanced at each other, then stepped forward, joining the prisoners. Branson stared at them all, watching silently, their faces still and expectant. Well, look at this, he thought. The Oracle gave me back my audience. He looked back up at the television, which was continuing to discuss the Oracle effect in all its many world-altering forms. God damn Will Dando. Still running the world, even though he hadn't appeared in public since that stunt in Denver, and hadn't communicated at all beyond his last one-word update to the site. One word, and it changed everything. Everything. The Oracle effect. Goddamn Will Dando, still running the world. Branson moved his eyes back to the lump of meat on his tray. I still have a choice, he thought. No one's making me do this. I have free will. He reached for the pepper shaker placed conveniently close to his plate, and heard a rustle of movement among the assembled watchers. What if I just don't?
he asked himself.
Word would get out. I could still do exactly what I was planning all along. The Oracle's just a man. I know it.
He looked up at the men standing around him, not meeting anyone's eyes, just taking their emotional temperature. Excitement. The beginnings of impatience. Certainty.
They know what I'm going to do. The Oracle said it, and they believe it, and that's that. But I can show them they're wrong. I still have free will, he thought again. I have a choice.
He stared at the pepper shaker in his hand. He did have a choice. But he knew what would happen to him if he disobeyed the Oracle in front of these men, who were so deeply invested in their prophet's infallibility. He would be made to season his steak as specified, and there would be pain then, and pain to follow. Punishment for his defiance. These people believed, certainly more strongly than anyone Branson had ever touched with his ministry. They wanted to see the Oracle's enemy brought low with their own eyes. The prediction would come true, one way or the other. They would see to it. The easy way, or the hard, cripplingly painful way. That was his actual choice, his only choice. It didn't matter what he believed, and it didn't matter what the Oracle was, God or man. The things he said came true. Reverend Hosiah Branson put pepper on his steak. He replaced the shaker on the table, lifted his spork, and carved himself a bite. Epilogue. Tomorrow. Lee shaded her eyes and peered out across the water, looking for three curved palm trees, partially uprooted by some long-past storm, so that they hung low over the beach, nearly horizontal, like permanent natural limbo sticks. The few channels into the shore weren't visible above the waterline. The sovereign nation of the Coral Republic was, in fact, ringed by a large coral reef, and the only safe way through was marked by the limbo palms. A concrete pier jutted roughly 100 yards into the sea from the beach, with mooring slips jutting out from the main pier at right angles. Once she was through the gate in the coral, Lee spun her boat's wheel to angle toward the nearest slip. She could see a figure walking along the beach to the pier to meet her. She smiled, but turned her attention back to bringing the boat in safely. Several vessels were already docked at the pier. A motorboat that was too small for Lee to feel comfortable using alone in the open ocean, and a palatial screw-you-I'm-rich yacht that was too large for her to pilot by herself. Lee thought Hamza had acquired the yacht just for the sheer satisfaction of owning a boat that big. She was driving the Florida Lady, a 30-foot fishing boat. Lee thought of it as hers, although technically she supposed it belonged to the Oracle organization. Will rarely took it out to any of the nearby islands. Too many people would recognize him, even down here. Hamza had arranged the Republic as its own country. She wasn't clear on the details, but the upshot was that it had its own set of laws, and it very pointedly had no extradition treaties. As long as the Oracle remained on the sandy ground of the Coral Republic, he was, in theory, legally untouchable. As Lee pulled the throttle back to idling speed and inched the lady forward into the mooring slip, she glanced to her right, where a short way back into the jungle off the beach, the orange tile roofs of what she and Will had both come to call the Capitol building poked through the treetops. It was really just a large, comfortable house built on stilts in a cleared area of the jungle, although it did house the entire population of the Republic. A flag flew out front, a stylized branch of yellow coral against a turquoise background. The boat bumped gently against the rubber tires placed at regular intervals along the side of the mooring slip. Lee turned off the motor and slipped quickly down from the cabin.
Will had made it to the end of the pier and stood waiting, his hands in his pockets. He was wearing shorts, sandals, and sunglasses, looking very appealingly sun-touched.
"Hey," Will said. "Any trouble?"
"Nope. Had to haggle a little bit to get a good price on dinner, but otherwise smooth sailing."
Lee picked up one end of a coil of rope on the deck and tossed it across to Will.
"What'd they have?" Will asked, catching the line neatly, and bending to secure it to a metal mooring cleat anchored into the pier. "Did you get that blue one? Tastes like salmon?"
They repeated the procedure with a second line at the stern. The whole operation was smooth, rehearsed, a far cry from their fumbling attempts when they first arrived at the island 4 months earlier.
"The Kalupalu market didn't have any today," Lee said, "but I got a couple of the big silver ones with the red tails."
Kalupalu was the nearest inhabited island, home to a fishing community of about 200 people.
"Okay?"
she asked. Will tugged on the line he had just tied down. He gave her a thumbs up, then looked at the boat's bow for a moment.
"We should rechristen this. Call it the Italian Lady," he said.
"What do you mean?"
Lee asked.
"I finally heard from Kathy and Becky. They went to Italy, to Portofino, after the coach thing. They've been lying low, but I guess they thought it was safe to get in touch."
"Are they okay?"
"Half the email was about obscure Italian wines they've discovered. They're fine."
Lee returned to the bridge briefly to gather her purchases. She pushed a button on the control console. A section of the Florida Lady's railing flattened and extended out, with a subtle whirring noise, into a gangplank across to the slip. She shouldered her bags, climbed down to the deck, and left her boat. Will took most of the bags, and they walked down the pier together. As they headed in toward the beach, Lee looked down at the sea. It was an impossibly clear shade of turquoise, like looking through an old Coke bottle at the seafloor. A school of red and gold tropical fish darted across the white sands, like a fleet of autumn leaves zipping through gently waving tendrils of seaweed. The one satchel Lee had kept was cold against her back, welcome in the equatorial heat. It was filled with ice, and inside that was a selection of fish caught earlier that morning by Kalupalu fishermen. Like the Feldspar Creek cabin, the Capitol building's kitchens were stocked with every type of freezable or non-perishable food imaginable. But there was no substitute for freshness. They crossed the beach and walked into the shade of the trees, along a gravel path cut into the jungle. A clearing opened up, revealing the Coral Republic Capitol building in all its splendor. It was basically a wide, square box built atop pillars, with double windows circling the entirety of the upstairs living space to ensure that the interior was always filled with air and light. The house was bright white with black accents, including shutters on the windows that could be closed against storms. Parquet floors, verandas everywhere. It was like something out of a Somerset Maugham novel. Will had told her the plan was based on something called a black and white house, which were used as quarters for British officers in Singapore during World War II. Whatever the provenance of the design, Lee loved it. She liked to sit upstairs in front of the windows facing the sea, and remember her tiny box of an apartment back in Manhattan. They entered the house and climbed the stairs. Will took the last bag from Lee.
"I'll put this stuff away. I found a recipe for a sweet fish curry with mangoes I want to try. It'll probably be better with the red tail anyway. Does that sound good?"
Lee smiled.
"Sure. Give it a shot."
Will's first tries at new recipes didn't always work out particularly well. They usually improved over time, but he was definitely sort of a trial-and-error cook. It made him happy, though, and she didn't mind the experiments. He was always quick to admit if something was inedible, and they'd scrounge up something else.
"Okay, it has to simmer for 3 or 4 hours. I'll take this stuff to the kitchen and put it together in a little bit, after my call. What are you going to do?"
I think I'm going to finish the story.
Will smiled.
Really? You got your ending?
Maybe.
Well, good luck, he said. I'm sure it's great.